Doris Kearns Goodwin is with us, a great historian known really as well for her availability on mass media in the electronic world, television and radio, as well as for Pulitzer Prize-winning books, an affinity now for Lincoln, the way you developed a taste for all of us, for Roosevelt, for the Johnsons, for the Kennedys. This business of looking at what is it that we find great. It seems that you, if you hadn't done Lincoln, you wouldn't have gotten to the subject in the way that America has done at its very best. I sort of wandered around that, but isn't greatness that?
Well, you know, I think even in Lincoln's own mind, what he was driven by was not simply to occupy some office, you know, or to have a set of powers, but to, as he said often, he wanted to somehow believe that he had accomplished something that would last. And that, if that's your goal, and that means it has to be a worthy ambition that lasts. It has to be something, as he said, that leaves the world a better place for his having been in it. And those words may sound trite, but they were his burning desire. And if you've got that as your goal, it just is like a lodestar. It helps you make the decisions along the way that a lot of other politicians would get stuck on because they're simply looking to get that office or to get that power or to increase the power. But his was as large as, I'm not sure whether there's an afterlife, and I want to be remembered. I don't want to be dust in a grave, so I have to somehow do something really worthy. And he surely did.
This is, to me, a wonderful study of egos. And of egos of many people who had, by most standards, a right to feel good about themselves and their accomplishments and their intellect and all the things that they were capable of doing. And also some examples. McClellan comes leaping to mind of some egos just hopelessly beneath contempt, at least in my reading of it. But it looks like an exercise in one way of Lincoln managing egos, his own to start with. But he seemed, I'm interested in your view of how he was able to do that. But more significantly, in this period, his ability to take these powerful egos and powerful people, all of whom more powerful than he was at the time he was nominated.
For president.
And manage them into an effective, not into submission, but into an effective working body to achieve the goals of the nation.
Yeah, I mean, not only were they rivals of his before he won the nomination, but they hated each other. I mean, so that's what's extraordinary, that he took conservatives, radicals, liberals, maybe today's world, and moderates together, and they called each other names that today would be astounding, an unmitigated scoundrel, a traitor, a
so
liar.
So what is a poltroon?
A poltroon, yeah. I wonder what a poltroon is, too.
It's not nice.
Apparently not.
Yeah, actually, I meant to look that word up. That's so
we'll
funny.
We'll do it together.
And can you imagine if we had such a thing today and it leaked out into the press that these guys were not even speaking to one another, they wouldn't go into each other's rooms. But on the other hand, somehow Lincoln was able to create an individual relationship with each one of them, so they felt somehow that they were respected by him, and they were able to do their own jobs incredibly well. I mean, he would have gotten rid of them if they hadn't occupied their own office well, but they were great secretaries of war. Even Chase, who was a pain in the neck, was a great secretary of the Treasury. And finally, he did understand that McClellan had to be let go. Maybe his patience with human beings went a little too far with Mr. George McClellan. His letters to his wife damned him forever in time and eternity.
This would be General McClellan, who for a very long time led the Army of the Potomac.
And somehow thought that God had placed him there and that he could cheerfully take on the role of dictator if he wanted it, and that all the other people surrounding him were responsible for all of his failures, in complete opposition to Lincoln, who would shoulder responsibility for the failures of his subordinates. When McClellan failed in the Peninsula campaign, mainly because he was outgeneraled, he blamed Stanton, he blamed Lincoln for not giving him enough soldiers. And Lincoln had to then give a major speech defending Stanton because there was a drumbeat to get rid of Stanton, because McClellan was popular, especially among the conservative Democrats at that time.
It's interesting to think about Lincoln, as you position him, as being temperamentally very conservative and very wary as he thought about his own positions. And that said, he never places blame on anybody. in your telling.
It's an astonishing thing to do, but it makes so much sense. You know, like when he was able to shoulder responsibility for Cameron, his first Secretary of War, who had, in ways that might sound analogous today, had let contracts out in the early day of the wars to suppliers and middlemen who made off with scandalous profits for weapons that didn't work.
And dead horses.
Exactly, and knapsacks that fell apart in the rain.
Well, and that endangered people's lives.
And endangered people's lives.
People died because of it.
No, that's exactly right. And so the Congress was going to censure him. And Lincoln, understanding that it was simply the chaos of the early days of the war, went and said, you know, all of us are to blame. And Cameron was forever grateful. And that way you create an ally. I mean, he's going to be somehow aware, I think, that doing the right thing is also the right political thing. That's what's so interested me about this. You can be a good person, but it also helps you prudentially to be a great politician.
Over and over and over again for his lifetime.
Right. And I guess you learn it. Once you learn it, it's hardwired in you as a temperament. But then you understand that it means that you every now and then have to just hold back a grudge that you might feel, forget a hurt that somebody exhibited towards you. And then in the long run, especially if you've got that big goal in front of you of doing something worthy for the test of time, you can deal with all these little things that come along the way.
Well, and back to that ego piece, it is, as you describe it, it's hard to see what I would normally consider an ego. Obviously, he had a clear sense of himself. He had faith in himself. He had a clear sense of purpose. He had no hesitation dealing with these other massive egos. But his sense of himself never seemed to get in the way.
Yeah, I mean, it really is. I'd love to have some psychological understanding of how that was possible. And I'm not sure that I do understand, because you're right, his ambition was huge. It's not that he was passive. He had burning desires. And yet he somehow understood that if he could remove his own short-term satisfaction from the equation, the longer-term goal might be met. You know, I mean, one of my favorite stories that he tells, which just shows how he took pleasure in this idea, he said he had had a dream. And in the dream, he was in a White House reception, and he overheard people looking at him and saying how common-looking he was. And he answered the people in the dream. He went up to them, and he said, well, God must like common people the best because he made so many of them. You know, and sort of that's his way. And then he woke up from the dream feeling great because he had somehow answered them. So clearly there was a sense of his awareness of people laughing at the way he looked. But to be able to just use it in that way, yes, most people are not beautiful people.
Well, and his sense of humor seems to be an immense part of that. I mean, the Lincoln we see, as you blessedly you describe, the reason he looks like he looks in everything we've ever seen is because you had to hold still
right.
to have a picture made, and that's why a $1 bill looks like a $1 bill.
Well, and this silly grinning at the camera thing that is now popular was not acceptable.
I mean,
then.
We hardly ever see anyone in the 19th century. It looks like they were just so sad all the time and grumpy and cranky because that's right. They have their neck is clamped to the back of a chair so they don't move, so they probably can't even smile if they wanted to. But everybody said the minute he began talking that a whole different idea came over his face. His eyes would sparkle and his life force and his vitality would come to the fore. And I'm not sure I had fully absorbed that, nor I think do most people, because he's a marble monument. He's on those bills and he looks so sad and stern, but he was anything but.
To laugh through a book about Lincoln that's really only a book about okay, so it's really four books, five books. It's Lincoln and it's Stanton, and it's Chase, and it's Seward, and it's Blair, and so you've braided these lives together, but this sense that Lincoln's going to be funny, and that he never, ever was at a loss for a story, and he would make people stay after the meeting
right,
was over
right.
so that he could enjoy laughing at his own jokes.
No, they said he laughed louder than anybody else, and the thing is that the stories often had a point to what was happening at that moment. One of the stories that I love that he told had to do with they were deciding what to do with Jefferson Davis after the war, and he wanted him to escape and the top Southern leaders to somehow, unbeknownst to him, because he couldn't say that, because there were so many people in his coalition who vindictively wanted to hang him. So he just wanted to escape unbeknownst to him. So then he said, that reminds me of a story. And he tells the story about a man who had taken the pledge against drinking and was going still grumpy about doing it, went to a friend's house, took the lemonade, sadly. The friend said, well, what if I put some brandy in, unbeknownst to you? And the guy lit up. Yeah, that's it. That's what I want, Jefferson Davis to escape, unbeknownst to me. I mean,
but he never said it.
No, he never could say that publicly.
He said it in the story.
He said it in the story, yeah. Exactly. Yeah. And it was almost like he had a computerized set of stories in his brain that something comes up and he could say, that reminds me of a story. And it just eased tension, or it somehow brought people together. Amazing.
I'm listening. It seems part of this was his ability. I mean, he had, as you described it, a tremendous empathic capacity, ability to empathize with mm-hmm. people. But in a way, it looks like an ability, and these stories go to that, an ability to radically contextualize everything, but contextualize it in a big way.
As in put it in a context?
And put it in the context, but the context of everything going on around him.
You know, that's really interesting. I'm not sure I'd fully thought of that, but when I think of the storytelling ability as a younger man, which carries him through his legal circuit. You know, everybody comes from miles around while he's running around in the courthouses in Illinois because they know this great storyteller is going to be there and they want to listen to him. And he could talk until midnight over and over. But then what did he do with the Gettysburg Address? In a certain sense, that's the great story for the country because it put in context, just as you say, the past of the country, the Declaration of Independence, the ideals of the nation, the sacrifices of the soldiers, and the future of this land, which would be a different place because of the sacrifices these soldiers had made. So what is in a certain sense, storytelling is something so deep, I think, in our psyche. It's not just a story at that moment, but it connects us to the past somehow, to our ancestors, and that's what stories are, going down from families over the generations.
To our ancestors and to those who come next, which would be us. This is Doris Kearns Goodwin, who has given us a sense of our ancestors, perhaps so that we could use that and move forward. We'll be back with her as we explore Abraham Lincoln and his team of rivals. Be with us when we return in a moment.